Welcome to Spectrum, a daily public affairs presentation of WCSM. And now, here's Spectrum, the talk of Mercer and Auglaize counties.
And we welcome you. Welcome aboard here to Spectrum. I'm your host, Kevin Sandler. We have a wonderful show today. Captain Guy Gruders is with us, a United States Air Force officer and fighter pilot known for his survival for over 5 years as a prisoner of war in Vietnam, born in Florida. But first of all, Guy, thank you so much for being here. But we want to quickly remind people, raised in Jersey, right?
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank
Kevin,
you.
That's great.
Thank you so much for being here. If you'd be so kind, you know, share with us a bit about your life. I know you spent your childhood, you know, you were an Eagle Scout. You had a lot of great hobbies. You made it to the Air Force Academy, I understand.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, brought up in North Jersey, went to the Air Force Academy, and out of there went right in the Air Force and got trained as a fighter pilot and then volunteered for Vietnam.
And
went over there.
And I was going to say, and if you share with us, obviously you flew missions in Vietnam, and it's you know, quick to say that you were shot down and captured, but I think people need to understand for you, that was the second time you were shot down, I understand.
That's right. Yeah, the first time we were rescued just offshore under heavy fire from the shore by the very brave men of the combat search and rescue crews. Helicopters came in under fire and got us out of the water.
The second time, obviously, you know, not as fortunate. You weren't able to get away, and yet I understand that the person that kind of turned you in, so to speak, saved you in that sense.
Right? Yes, he did. Right. When they found me, I got away from them a couple times. The third time, they found me in the jungle. I was a crew of it was a squad of 12 soldiers by a local militia commander, like a National Guard troop, you know, that kind of thing. And this guard commander, who was in a separate little hat than the regular soldiers, you know, they captured me with AK-47s, and they brought me out of the jungle. When I got into the rice paddy, had hundreds of effectively peasants charging from all directions, screaming with machetes. And we had seen, I had seen a couple of pilots cut the ribbons by crowds like that, you know, as we rescap, they call it, you know, you help other people get out when they're shot down. I'd seen a couple of guys shot to down, cut to pieces by crowds like that. But what this guy did was he had his troops draw their bayonet and surround me with the bayonets facing out. The crowd still kept coming in, but then he gave a command. He had the troops lower the bayonets, but then he shouted out, "The next command is fire." And the crowd stopped. And then he gave another command, and they opened a circle, and they brought me out. This is eight or nine at night. They brought me to a place about 11 at night, and a woman cooked me a cassava meal, like a potato meal, at 11 at night in this little abandoned bamboo hut. Turns out that was the guy's wife. So he saved me from being cut to pieces by the crowd with drawn bayonets of his troops. And then he brought me to this village, his little village, very small village in the middle of nowhere, probably 1,000 people. And I stayed there 4 days and then was turned over to the regular military and brought on convoys up to North Vietnam in the regular prison systems, and just went. You know, you mentioned I just went back there last couple years ago, really, in 2023, and met that guy that saved my life.
And what were, you know, you able to talk about? That I'm sure was overwhelming, you know, for the two of you.
Well, it was actually, what happened was is that we were brought out to his village, and he had myself and my son and his wife and my daughter out to his home for an afternoon. And there were 20 people from that rescue area, the rescue day, that were there, including two of the soldiers that had rifles on me in the jungle when they first captured me. And also he had, this guy was 84 years old now, this militia commander, and he still was in the uniform that he wore when he captured me. He put on the same uniform. He's 84 years old. He had 8 kids, and his youngest kid had that Down syndrome. You know, it was a girl, and she was about 60 years old, and she was there. And so there was a number of the villagers there. The interesting thing is, when I was shot down, the plane got hit. When it got hit, it was at 1,500 feet. It rolled over on its back and went right into the ground. It was a very fast shoot down and into the ground at 500 miles an hour. So we ejected upside down at about 1,000 feet. Just barely got a shoot before we hit the ground. So very, very amazing that we lived through that shoot down. But the interesting thing was the plane was right there next to the village. So he went out and he took the nose wheel strut from the wreckage of the F-100 fighter, and he had that in his living room. And it was this is something 6 or 8 feet long and big, thick piece of steel. And he actually, when he heard we were coming out, he had it cut up into pieces and gave me 3 pieces of that nose wheel strut of my fighter that I was shot down in 55 years earlier. Okay. This is a really nice guy. He really was one heck of a guy. Number one, if you can imagine facing down your whole village with bayonets to keep them from killing an enemy pilot that was parachuting down in the outskirts of your village, that's what he did. I mean, I don't think there's one man in 100 in the whole world that would do that.
And I would also, add so that people understand that after that, obviously, things got really hard for you. The place you were taken to is what was notoriously called the Hanoi Hilton. Read about it. And for you, unfortunately, release would not come for over 5 years until 73 when the remaining prisoners were finally released.
That's right. Yeah, I was in 6 different prison camps. I was in the Hanoi Hilton for 2 different stays. But yeah, we were released in 1973. And it was a wonder. We never thought we'd get out of there, but they had a Christmas bombing in 1972, B-52s. And my brother was one of the pilots in one of those B-52s. So my brother literally helped to bomb me out of there, because we never would have got out of there without that bombing.
How did that help you to get out? Did you simply get out, or did their government decide?
No, they stopped the war. The North Vietnamese signed a surrender. They surrendered, really, in January because of that bombing in late December. They surrendered and let us all come home and actually let South Vietnam be free. And then when we got out of there, 2 years later, they invaded again. And the Congress didn't want any part of it, and they kept us from going back in to fight them again.
And that was 1975, right?
That was 75. That's right. In 1970, we were released in March, and February and March of 73, and a couple of years later in 75, they invaded again, a complete new invasion to build up their forces again and all that kind of thing. And this time there was no United States to help them, and they were conquered.
For you, did your family know you were alive? Were you ever allowed to write
your
family?
Well, that was interesting, too. Actually, Sandy didn't really get a letter from me for over 2.5 years after a trip to after a pilgrimage that she made to Saint Anne de Beaupré up by Montreal in Canada, to that saint up there. And on the way home, she was told by her friend, called her on the phone and said that she had received a letter from me. So for 2.5 years, she didn't really know that I was alive. And that was standard. They didn't let us write unless you agreed to help them somehow, they wouldn't let you write. So nobody wrote. But after 2.5 years, the ladies, Sandy and all these ladies, had made such a ruckus that how could they keep us without letting people know who was alive or dead? There were 3,500 pilots missing, and they didn't know who was alive or dead for those first 2.5, 3 years. And so everybody was saying, how can you be so cruel? So they finally let us all write a letter home, the ones that were still alive. There were still 500 pilots alive, and we wrote home, and Sandy then knew that we were that I was alive at that time.
And so people also understand, they might offer you some things if you would help them out. You guys weren't willing to help them out.
No, we were not willing to help them out. We had a very good unit up there, excellent leadership, and we followed the code of conduct, which is no help to the enemy, no matter what they do.
And also, so people understand, it's not as if you're all allowed to be together, hang out together, right? I mean, did you have to have like a kind of a tap code to even
communicate? Yeah, we had a tap code. Yeah, we were kept isolated in 1- and 2-man rooms for those first three years. I was with one other man, and you weren't allowed to tap through the wall or communicate at all. In fact, if they heard you, above a whisper, then you got a week or two of bad torture. Because they wanted to keep you isolated so they could work on you as the interrogators. It's much easier to work on somebody. As an example, Kevin, I tell you as an interrogator, Kevin, you're the only one that's resisting. Everybody else has given us what we want. Only you, Kevin. Only you. Okay? And they're screaming at you and hitting you and beating you and torturing you. And it's easy for you to believe that unless you're tapping through the walls and knowing that under orders, everybody is resisting. A lot easier to resist when you know everyone is resisting.
Amazing that, and again, a lot of people couldn't even understand that. But as you said, no way to the enemy means just that. And for you and your fellow soldiers, this is about honor, and you don't give an inch.
That's right. That was what it was. It was total trust in God. Frankly, we had a lot of prayer up there. And we trusted in God doing the right thing, and that's it, period. And they killed a lot of guys, and, we lost 6 out of 7, and it didn't matter. We didn't care what they did. The rest of us just, everybody just kept, we're not giving you a thing, that's it.
What was it, your faith in God that kept you going? I mean, talk about a hopeless situation.
Oh, yeah, it was truly hopeless, but only God. Everybody says the same thing, only prayer. Kept us going. That was our first communication from our leadership through the walls by the tap code. When we learned the tap code, was that every Sunday at noon, on Sunday they would sound a gong for a siesta at noon for them. They would take a siesta, and when they sounded that gong, we would all say the Our Father, the 23rd Psalm, and the Pledge of Allegiance. And we knew that even though we were solo or in torture, that all other POWs were saying those prayers with us at noon on Sunday. And then every day we would say our other prayers, and so on.
Now for you, when you were, finally free, let's talk about what came next for you. Obviously, you probably never thought you were going to get out. Now you are. What was next for you? How did you go on?
The way that happened, it was really interesting. We were up in dungeons. We were in a camp that were really literally dungeons in the mountains, in the jungles, no electricity, no nothing, up by the Chinese border. 200 of us were kept up there because they figured that we'd never have another raid like we had a Santé prison raid. To try to get some of us out. So they figured the only way to keep us safe was put us up within a couple miles of the Chinese border, because that was a no-fly zone, 10 miles from the border for the U.S. Air Force and Navy. So they put us up in those dungeons in those mountains, and that's where we were. And they told us when we went up there that we would never be going home and that we were going to stay there till we died. That if we ever left there, it would only be because somehow the war would end, that they'd won the war and that when we would come back. Of course, we knew that they were never going to win the war, So we figured, well, we're going to just die up there. That's it. But then in January, each month they had a truck come up with rations for the month. We had bread and water, basically. And they'd bring up enough for the month for the 200 of us in a truck. So each month you'd hear this truck coming up, these 5,000 or 6,000. This was the foothills of the Himalayas to the east. And so you'd hear these truck engines. You know how you hear truck engines wind up a mountain? So we'd hear this truck engine wind up in the middle of the night, and then it would come in. And it came in on about the 5th of January, 5th of each month. And that, each month that happened. And another, no other trucks ever came up there. But then on about the 10th of January, on about the 15th or so of January, a second truck came up. And so we couldn't believe it. So we were in dungeons with no windows or anything, but there was a vent way up high, pitch black dungeons. So one guy got on another guy's shoulder. At this time, in that last few months, we had about five or six guys in each of these cells. The one guy got on and he looked through the vent and he saw this truck come out. And when he pulled into the camp, the truck pulled out of the parking place, which was only a place for two trucks in the middle of these dungeons. He pulled up into the jungle. So we said, holy mackerel, could this be that we're actually going out of here? Which we knew that we're going to possibly be getting home, getting out of prison camp, which none of us figured that would ever happen. So sure enough, now we're listening and we hear another truck about 30 minutes later come up, winding up the roads. The guy gets up on the shoulders and looks at the vent, and the other truck comes in and pulls again out of the parking place into the jungle. By 2 o'clock, we had, you know, literally 10 trucks in that clearing, and they loaded us up on those trucks and started back. And as we're going, they have 20 guys in a truck. You're blindfolded. You're in irons, leg irons, and handcuffs. So we're getting thrown around in pitch blackness in the trucks. So everybody's vomiting over each other and so on. So when they stop for gas, you know, to refuel, which is from 55-gallon drums, our commander said to the commander of the convoy, you know, let these guys have a break. You know, they're sick as a dog and they're throwing up all over the place and so on. So the guy says, don't worry, you'll be home soon. So that went around like lightning. That was on the way back to Hanoi. And sure enough, on the 20th of January, they read us a peace agreement. And then we were in a number of releases. We were in the third release. We came home in March, 14th of 1973.
And for you, I'm sure you probably felt great relief to be back on American soil. Is that where you went right away, back to America?
Well, we actually went to the Philippines.
Okay, yes.
And to try to give us a date, and they fitted us out for, we were in pajamas for 5 or 6 years, prison pajamas. So they fitted us out with uniforms. So when we came back to the States to meet our family, we were in regular uniforms and things like that, had clothes, had underwear. We had no underwear in prison camp, and so on.
For you, please, share with us, what your life was like after that. I know you obviously were honored by the military with a number of medals. You were, able to retire. You became an author, a speaker. You've had quite the life since then.
Well, we had a little bit. Yeah, we didn't. I actually retired from the military. That's August. I was pretty badly beat up, a lot of problems, a lot of physical problems, and basically went into the IBM for quite a while, and then I was an IBM salesman in New York. Sold computers, that kind of thing. I had an engineering education, so I went through the IBM schools. That lasted 5 or 6, 7 years. Then they had the airlines offered me a job, Eastern Airlines. And I said, I have a lot of problems. They said, well, you should be able to fly an airliner. So I couldn't fly a fighter, but I could fly an airliner. So I was with the airlines, 17, 20 years, retired from the airlines, and then went into a computer business with my brother and did a lot of speaking since then, all
yes.
over the place.
Never truly retired.
Never truly retired.
That's all right. That's all right. Now, for you these days, you do speak to people,
I do,
right?
Speaking, yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. Try to do a lot of gardening at home, but generally, as far as the professional thing is concerned, I've written another, two or three books, and I do a lot of speaking. I enjoy speaking to all kinds of audiences.
I'm sure they have everything from a lot of questions for you to they just want to shake your hand, right?
Yeah, well, really, yeah. Yes, there's a lot. Everybody's very, very friendly and very nice, okay? But generally, I have very good talks on leadership. I was telling you, we had outstanding leadership. I've got great leadership. I was one of the very youngest POWs in North Vietnam. So I can speak about leadership because I was not one of the leaders. So I can speak, I really can tell great leadership stories. And and of course the prison camp itself is so completely different that it's like a TV show or something like that, that you can't believe, you can't understand. You've never seen anything like a communist prison camp. It's just so completely alien to anything in the United States.
No question. Guy, I want to thank you so much for being here. It's certainly an honor to talk to you. And I would like to remind people, too, to do an internet search. It's Guy Gruters, G-R-U-T-E-R-S, and they will find out more about you. They will find a way to buy your books, of course, if they would like to do that. Perhaps they can contact you if they would like a speaker. I mean, there's a lot people can do if they would like to learn more.
Yes, sir. That's true. That's great. Thanks, Kevin. That's great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A real pleasure.